This is Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe. Now, here's Patrick McEnroe.
All right, time for another edition of Holding Court, everyone. Patrick McEnroe here, and it's usually this time in January every year that I make the trip down under to Melbourne, Australia for the Australian Open. I've been so lucky to go there every year since 1991. So this year is the first year I will not be making the trip with my cohorts at ESPN. Of course, for many years I went as a player since my playing days finished, which was a little bit of a relief because my bank account got a lot better once I started getting into broadcasting. And one of the things I love about going down under is that every year I get to visit my good buddy who's going to join me today on this podcast. And before I even had any idea how famous he is in Australia and around the comedy world for all the things that he's done throughout his unbelievable career in TV, film, satire, live TV in Australia. Every year when I go down under, he welcomes me to his house, his amazing wife, Jane. They've got five beautiful kids, to have a little Shiraz, right, Robbie? A little Shiraz and a little steak on the Barbie at your house in Melbourne. And I got to tell you, Rob, I'm going to miss that as much as anything else. It's my favorite tournament every year to go down under, and I always look forward to that little time we get to spend together during week number two of the tournament when my schedule is a little bit lighter. So welcome to Holding Court. I appreciate you joining me from down under, and what the hell is happening down there?
Well, it's a privilege to be on the podcast, Pat. And I must say, it's really strange after, I mean, you've been coming over to our house since last century.
Yep.
And each year, it's funny to not have you here this year. And it's a strange, I often say to people, when's the best time to come to Melbourne? And I think it's those 2 weeks of the Australian Open. I think it's, you know, it's a holiday atmosphere, the tennis complex, which keeps improving year on year, is virtually in the middle of the city. So you don't really need to get a taxi or an Uber. You can walk from your hotel. It's a really wonderful time and place to be.
It sounds like not too many people, Rob, are walking from their hotel, at least the tennis players at this stage, because of the quarantine issues going on. For the 72 players are in a full 14 in the middle of a full 14-day lockdown, and then the other players who didn't have anyone test positive on their flights are allowed to leave their rooms for 5 hours. So a lot of us here in our country, and I know you follow especially what's going on in politics here in this country, Rob, you and I have had just so many amazing discussions about that over the years, but you know, we can't quite grasp when I tell people here in New York where I live, you know, in Australia everything's normal, everyone, I mean, they're going to restaurants, they're walking around, no masks. So how did you do it, and how is the fact that these tennis players are coming in from all over the world affecting the mood and the vibe of the Australian public?
So first things first is to say that Australia loves this tournament, the whole country, not just that town. It rates hugely on TV. The first 8 pages of every newspaper is Australian tennis coverage. I think the players get a shock when they come here and they realise they're the main game in town. And it's LeBron who? It's tennis.
Right, yeah.
There's a bit of history to when the coronavirus trouble spiked, which was in March, our government sort of threw the kitchen sink at it, both states. We've got about 8 states and territories. They threw the kitchen sink at it. And just in case, most of it worked. Mm-hmm. And the case numbers plummeted. And across the Tasman Sea, New Zealand had an even stricter lockdown. And that was in the kitchen sink plus, and that worked as well. And so by about the end of April, it was pretty much zero around the country. But all the standard things, you know, the lockdowns, masks, case tracing. And then we started letting people back in from overseas, you know, Australian citizens who need to get back. And so we developed a quarantine system, and that worked in most states.
Mm-hmm.
But we had severe problems in our state, which is Victoria, where Melbourne is. And it got out of control, and we had a genuine second wave while the rest of the country didn't. And so literally they threw 3 kitchen sinks at it.
Mm.
And it was 4 months of lockdown while the rest of the country was pretty much operating as normal. Our borders were shut. It was quite draconian. And there'll be a lot of argument over what it worked and what didn't. But anyway, the cases again plummeted. And so when the players came in with the tennis and were a little shocked by how serious
they took it, right?
Yeah, it was. I think most players were supportive, but I think some players were surprised at how vehement the people of Melbourne and Australia were in this, the hotel lockdown system and the quarantine system.
Yeah, because when you say to me, Rob Sitch from Australia, that you had a huge spike in cases in Melbourne, which is, as you said, in the biggest city in the state of Victoria in Australia, I mean, that's about as many cases I had on my block, you know, in the suburbs of New York City. I mean, you know, I think there was 30 cases or something. But so obviously it's a lot different the way things have gone down here and the way our government has not been able to control this pandemic. So when you talk about some of the draconian measures, you know, particularly sort of closing down, you're talking about closing down the border from Melbourne into other parts of Australia, correct?
Total lockdown. So it's interesting. I think both New Zealand and Australia and all of our states realised that a pretty severe lockdown, mask wearing and closing of all indoor gyms and restaurants.
Right.
I think it's been, you know, our states, we're a big country, and so the states almost are like islands. And it became pretty clear what worked. I mean, it hurt a lot of business. And it was pretty tough on a lot of people. But I think everyone learned pretty early that as long as there was the political will, mm-hmm. you could get the case numbers under control pretty quickly. And so in Melbourne now, we've had zero cases for 3 weeks, virtually.
Wow.
The only cases that come in are from overseas.
Unbelievable. So those tennis players, so what are you sensing from the general population, because I said you've made a career out of being sort of a political satirist. You know, you started your own production company it's almost 30 years now, Working Dog Production. You've made a few movies that have been very successful. You wrote them, directed them, and I know you work with your teammates at Working Dog on a lot of the TV shows that you've done that have been hugely successful, Frontline, The Panel. And is Utopia the most recent one? I know you won a Logie Award, which is the Australian equivalent of an Emmy Award. You've won about, I think, 7 or 8 of those throughout your career. But is that the most recent TV show that you've had on full air in Australia?
Yeah, it is. It is, Pat. And we came up with this idea that, I don't know, 20 years ago you never heard the word infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, people are throwing billions of dollars at bridges and tunnels. And of course, they all sort of blow out or the planning goes wrong. And it would just seem such a sort of a funny subject that it's sort of when smart people go stupid. You know, you sort of, it's very hard to plan and predict these massive projects. And so we thought that was, you know, I must admit, we're a little concerned when we were pitching an idea, a comedy, and it's all about infrastructure.
Well, you know, we had Infrastructure Week like all the time with Trump. It just never happened. We're still waiting for Infrastructure Week.
It's like a health plan.
We're still waiting. You know, waiting. It's like Godot. what was it like watching? Because you sent me a very funny text as we were setting the time up for us to be able to do this with, you know, you being the next day in Australia and so on. You know, once we get over the I think you said it was the riots and the protests, right? Or the insurrections. Mm. So when you look at, and I know you every time I come and see you every year, Rob, you talk about, you know, different TV shows that have inspired you, that, you know, American shows. I think you've inspired, quite honestly, a lot of American shows, particularly when I look at what you did with The Panel and Frontline, which were, you know, kind of political. It was wasn't one of them live to air all the time?
And that
was like a political satire show, right? And now you have that, it's all over the place in the U.S. Anyway, what were you making of what you were seeing happening in our country here? Because I know you pay close attention.
it's probably worth saying that Australians are, I mean, you've experienced this every year. Australians are very fond of America. They're very fond of American culture and sports, and they're quite admiring of the Republic. You know, you're not scared of the civics too much, but, you know, it's the traditions and norms and the constitution. I took my kids to Washington last year. Mm-hmm. On this very day, I stood in front of the Bill of Rights and, you know, that wonderful archive building in Washington.
Right.
And, you know, just to see it, you know, nearly 250-year-old, such a clever document. And so when a kind of the rumblings of insurrection raised, I think Australia just looked on and shook their head and said, what are you guys doing? This is, you're playing with fire with this thing, with something that's so amazing.
Now, when you look at it from your perspective, okay, and I mean, can you imagine if you were making your own television show? Because I know I've seen a lot of your impersonations over the years. You did a great impersonation of Ross Perot, who a lot of people wouldn't even probably remember this country. Bill Clinton, okay, you did a great Clinton. But a lot of political people in Australia that obviously people here wouldn't know about. But who would you be the person you would most like to impersonate from American politics right now?
Well, you can't go past Donald Trump. It's because his cadence and his use of words and pauses is, and there's some absolutely wonderful impersonators in America. But his just use of, you know, when he hosted a winning American sports team and there was a shutdown, and so they ordered in McDonald's or something.
Right. It was like, I think it was a college goes, you know, college football team. Yeah.
And so he said, "We have burgers, many, many fries."
the greatest fries.
When he pardoned the turkey, this is one lucky turkey.
Oh, my God. Keep going, please.
Well, I can say that the joke in that sense, Pat, is on us, because For personal reasons that you know, we weren't going to host a Christmas dinner this year, and I said, "What's the lowest amount of effort we can go to still get our family together and have a really enjoyable?" And I said, "Why don't we do what Donald Trump did with that sporting team at the White House?"
Right.
So we recreated the fast food celebratory banquet via a drive-through, and our kids thought it was the greatest Christmas that ever experienced.
Your five children, they range in age, what, were they early teens now up until you have some that are even past their teenage years, right?
Yeah, well, I've got my daughter has got her own license and drives a car, we were just talking about this the other day. They find new ways to make you stressed.
Right, right. Oh, God, that must have been. I hope you have some of that on video. I'm sure it's not for publication, but some of that, the drive-through, picking up the burgers.
I'll send you, when we're off air, I'll send you a couple of photos.
Oh, my goodness. Now,
as I said, burgers, shakes, and many, many fries.
Now, one of the memories I have of you, Rob, when you came over here was when one of your movies got picked up by one of the big American companies. I believe it was the first one you did, The Castle, right? Was it The Castle or The Ditch? Yeah, there's a castle.
No, it's The Castle.
Yeah.
Picked up by Miramax,
and it was Harvey Weinstein, of course, who at that time wasn't in jail. But I remember you and she wasn't your wife at the time, but you guys have been together forever, Jane Kennedy. Now you guys are actually married now, right?
No.
You're not.
In our country, there's no defense.
There's no, okay. So, but basically, you know what I'm saying. Basically, I mean, Jane is, by the way, an incredible talent herself and has been part of your team forever. She's had her own radio show for the last couple of years in Australia, and I've been lucky enough to be on that. And she's also just a ridiculous cook. So I'm going to miss that. Your Shiraz and her, you know, beef that she makes or puts on the Barbie, whatever she comes up with is phenomenal. So anyway, you come at one point, I think it was in the middle of winter, if I remember correctly, because you invited me to one of the viewings of the movie, The Castle, to go to some theater in New Jersey somewhere, I think it was. And it was, and that's kind of what where you like test out the movie. Is that what happens? And Harvey Weinstein actually came to that. So what do you remember about that whole experience?
Look, it's funny. Something as simple as accent, because we grow up with so much British TV and American TV, we it's almost like our brain doesn't even have to work to understand words said in a different accent. But I think that when all of your media is in the American accent, to hear an Australian accent takes that bit of extra effort. And so that was one of the biggest surprises we had, is that words that we would not even think of being said too quick for people to understand almost had to be artificially slowed down or changed or... You know, and it's funny. It's funny. I was saying this to someone the other day. An Australian can be in a crowd of 1,000 people, and they can all be talking at the one time. Say, you know, overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's one Australian that says one word, our ears can pick it up.
Right.
And if that person is an Australian but they're a New Zealander, we know they're a New Zealander within two or three words.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's a result of we're a very big immigrant nation, and all we hear is media. Most of our media is from elsewhere, movies and things like that. And so we're entirely comfortable with that, but we have to be extremely conscious of our accent. And one of the things I notice when I go to America, depending on the state, often people will say, "Excuse me," when I've said something very, very clearly, and you have to realize that the brain is just catching up with a really quite a foreign accent in many ways.
When you look back at how you started out, Rob, because I mean your history as an individual is incredible. That you were actually you studied to become a doctor, and you actually did practice medicine for a short period of time. And I know you sort of had gotten into acting a little bit, that side of it. And then the way you and I met was that actually you went to Harvard to business school there. And I believe like midway through while you were in school, you said like, "I'm out of here." That's how we had a mutual friend, one of my best friends growing up, and you and him became friends. So that's how sort of you and I connected over the years. So tell me a little bit about the medicine part and then about that trip to Harvard and what made you say, "You know what, I'm out of here."
That was sort of family circumstances in the end. It's that, you know, I think everyone, most people had a sick parent, and I had two. But I did medicine. No one in my family had studied anything to do with the biological sciences. And I thought, gee, that's interesting. You know, it struck me as being something quite different. But the first time I looked down the microscope, I was shocked that you could actually see a cell.
Right.
And then we have direct entry in less so now, but we don't have to do a degree and then go to medical school. I was 17 and I went straight into the Royal Melbourne medical stream and really enjoyed it and really enjoyed the people. But then somewhere along the way, I thought, God, I've never tried acting, and I might just try out for this small college play that just about everyone who auditioned for got in. And I was one of the people who didn't get in.
Right.
I think 27 people auditioned and 25 got in, and I didn't.
Yeah, right. You're one of the two.
One of the two. So I thought, geez, I better back up and try that again next year. And I got in, but my role was, Thornton Wilder had a play called Our Sound, an American play we did, and it required sound effects, and I was the guy that was doing the sound effects on the chair at the back, like even
Like in the old, like in the old, like in the old radio shows when it's to come up with like, you know, yeah, scratching, yeah, stuff. Right. Okay.
So I feel like they can feel that my audition was up to scratch again. And a mate of mine who was also in medicine had the role of the Undertaker, and he said it was so poor he's leaving the play. And I got that. and I really loved the process. And then as he was walking out, he said, I'm going to try out for this comedy review. Why don't you come with me? And that's how it started. And so we just did, you know, sort of like Second City and sketches.
Right.
And sort of one thing led, you know, a lot of times I look back and I go, it was sliding doors and a lot of luck. But we got the breaks early and then met up with a lot of similar people that were, most of my friends were doing law, JD, and they weren't really enjoying that. And then one thing led to another. And then sort of in the mid-90s, I always wanted to do something postgraduate.
Mm-hmm.
And really loved the way that Harvard teaches. And, you know, it's a bit of a long shot. But I guess with my background helps and the sort of odd bits in my Wikipedia entry. And went and lived in Boston and was hoping to complete it, but two sick parents got in the way, and I was the doctor in the family, and it took a lot of management. But I you know, I just absolutely loved the way it was taught. You know, they call it the Socratic method, but I you know, the classes could have gone 3 hours and I wouldn't have blinked.
Right. And now when you look back at obviously the numerous films you've done, but I say most of the stuff you've done, Rob, has been in television, as you said, in sketch comedy and writing and creating these types of shows out of these ideas. Has that been what has been the most enjoyable to you? I know you've done a couple of hilarious travel books, which are just unbelievable. Well, but what is it about the television that you think, is it because it happens quickly, you can do it sort of on the fly? What is it about that that's seemingly been what's you concentrated on the most throughout your career?
Well, I often say this, that the light bulb went off when I saw This Is Spinal Tap, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the style of their acting and their comedy, and it was almost like I go, that's me. That's what I love doing. That absolute deadpan verisimilitude. No one in it looks like they know that this joke at all. And it was not that I wanted to send up rock music, but it's just the execution and the style of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, had I never seen that film, I'm not sure the light switch would have gone off and said that. But in my head, I went, oh, that's what I truly love. And so we've done a lot of series. We were fortunate. A lot of the technology of cameras improved just when we needed them. So most television shot in studios, and we sort of pioneered taking over office buildings, changing the lighting around and shooting 360 degrees so that it looked like a real office because it really was a real office.
Mm-hmm.
And we used these little light small cameras to create this. People call it like a mockumentary,
but right.
Our style was, we never tried to consciously make it look like a documentary. It just looked real. And the number one rule was nobody in the show is aware that something ridiculous is going on. And
right.
So we've done maybe three different shows. But you mentioned the travel book and enjoyment. Probably the thing I've enjoyed most in my entire career is I've been working with a couple of friends for nearly 30 years. And we went on a holiday to Portugal together with one of those Michelin guides. And they were preparing to be the capital of Europe or some UNESCO thing. And everywhere we went had scaffolding up as they were cleaning these old cathedrals. And one day one of my friends read out, he goes, oh, it's the Church of the Basilica Santa Margarita. Some of the scaffolding dates back to the 13th century. And we started doing this as a game where we'd wait for people to get the game,
right,
and then we'd read from the Michelin and then throw in jokes. And 10 years later, the guy that invented that said, Oh, remember that idea I had of writing a travel book to a country that doesn't exist? And the other two of us went, no, you didn't say that to us.
Right.
That's
right.
The best idea we've ever heard. And so people will be shocked, but we invented a country in Eastern Europe called Moldavia.
Right.
And wrote 300 pages of a travel guide with hotels, restaurants, and...
So you were Borat, you were Borat before Borat.
Right.
Basically, yeah.
A lot of similar sensibilities. Mm-hmm. But it got translated into German, and it became a top 10 bestseller in German because this wonderful translator was able to capture the humor.
Right.
And then after that, it got translated into 30 languages, and it was published in America, Britain. And then we did two more countries. Viva San Sombrero, which was sort of a Central American country. We tried to pick places when, if you looked at the map, you don't know where Costa Rica is or Guatemala.
Right. So Nicaragua.
We squeezed in an extra.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there was Fake Tan, right?
Fake Tan was there was a, that was the capital city of Bumper to Bumper. Which and the hospital has a statue to the only man who's ever suffered from constipation.
Oh my goodness, oh, that's just so too much.
When you ask what's enjoyable, I've got to say, making those books was.
Now, where can good old-fashioned Americans find your shows? Because one of the things I always get educated by you, Rob, when I come. When I come to your house and when I see you, we get together during the Australian Open, you always say, Patrick, have you seen this? And I'm like, I'm so oblivious. I'm like, no, what are you talking about? He goes, oh, it's the best show. It's in, you know, a new show on Netflix or Amazon. And you always are, I mean, obviously it's your business, so it's a cutting edge. But first of all, tell me where can I find your shows? If online, can I go to? Are you on Netflix? Are you on Amazon? Where are some of your shows at? I mean, Utopia, I saw a few clips on YouTube. And hilarious.
So it's hard because you'll get geo-blocked in most of it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big networks here is like your NPR, PBS, called Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC.
Right.
You can try that. They started a streaming service like 15 years ago that almost felt like it led the world. It's absolutely wonderful, but I think it's got geo-blocked. Occasionally our shows come up on Netflix. Somewhere in between all the period dramas, you might find one of our shows. But it's, I think there's a streaming services. Stan was one of them. YouTube, you can find them, but don't be prepared to be geo-blocked.
Well, YouTube, I can find a lot of good clips, you know, of The Late Show and of some of the shows and some of your impersonations. There's a whole thing of Rob Sitch impersonations, which is just absolutely phenomenal. And we got a little bit of Trump here. And what about President Biden? Before I let you go, and you've given me already a huge amount of time, which I greatly appreciate, what do you make of President Biden and sort of what he's bringing? We sort of feel, I think, in this country, like, okay, like, you know, take a breath. You know, I don't need to watch the political news every single night now. I could actually maybe start watching some other programming on television. Because, you know, with Trump, it's like I said to my buddy who works at CNN, I said, well, here's the good news and the bad news. The good news is Trump's gone. The bad news is Trump's gone, like for your ratings. Because I'm like, I'm interested in politics, but I sort of became more obsessed with politics in the last couple of years. And now I'm like, okay, maybe I could take a breath and like get back to like watching some other stuff. So what's your take on Biden number one? And then I need a couple of great shows because you always give me, since I'm not going to be with you in Australia, give me a couple of great shows I should watch.
So Biden seems to represent, you know, the country taking one big, deep breath. But what's interesting is we always associate White House administrations. When you look at their Wikipedia, they topped, you know, Stanford Law School, and then, you know, ambassadors of 47 countries, and then negotiated a nuclear arms agreement, and then they were tapped to be a second level, deputy secretary. So, and that's our image of White House administration.
Right.
And in the sort of the last sort of 6 months of the Trump administration, it was It feels like the bar got lowered a bit.
Just a touch, huh?
Just a touch. So I think the Biden, even the first week of Biden, it's the image that, you know, Australians associate with America. It's sort of, you know, you've got a lot to argue about, but.
We got our shit together. We got our problems, but for the most part, we kind of got our shit together. Even though there's obviously a lot of issues.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ron Klain is chief of staff, but you go back. He led the Ebola. Right. You know, Biden led the reconstruction after the global financial crisis.
Right.
It's sort of. I know the Washington types get a bad rap occasionally, but I think nobody does that administration experience like the Americans.
All right, and tell me what I need to watch. What's a good new show? Because when I did watch Utopia, by the way, it kind of reminded me a little bit of one of my favorite shows, and I know my daughter's favorite show, the 14-year-old, The Office. You know, which of course was a classic. Yeah. It's got a little bit of that deadpan stuff in it. So what are you watching now?
We got hooked. This, you know, this again might take a bit of effort. There's a French program called Le Bureau.
Okay,
and you know when you recommend shows to people, you know, you know, Schitt's Creek, you know, you've got to stick with it for the first, you know, everyone comes and goes from these shows. Bridgerton, someone will watch it and go up to their, you know, scene, and then two episodes later says, I think I'm over Regency England. But Le Bureau is a French series about their CIA and NSA.
Okay, interesting.
And I've recommended it to maybe a dozen people. And my strike rate is 100%. Everyone's gone through it. It's absolutely brilliant.
The Bureau. And is it on Netflix or where is it at?
Well, I mean,
we don't know.
It might take a Google search. We got it on one of our catch up programs here, but I think I saw it in a top 10 in the New York Times. Someone said their top 10 of the year. So I think it's accessible.
Well, I'm going to miss our chats, Rob, and it's bittersweet. You know, it's awesome you were able to make a little time and talk to me now. You know, we'll stay in touch during the Australian Open when it actually starts in about two. But I will be, Rob, just so you know, in beautiful Bristol, Connecticut, which is the home of ESPN, and I will be freezing my ass off. The good news, it's only about an hour and a half from where I live in New York. And I will be on, we will be on the air during, like, we're always on the air all day in Australia. The only problem is that it'll be about 8 p.m. here until approximately 6 to 7 a.m. Australia time. So,
you know what? As you're technically a dual citizen after all these years, for those that don't know, Pat is loved in Melbourne and by all our big sportscasters because he's, you're sort of an adopted son of the town and the event. And over the years, I must say, you talk about impersonations and accents. You do a pretty mean Australian accent when you want.
Just, and this is just going to be for me, okay, because most of my fans who listen, the Australian fans will know, he's one of the great broadcasters. He's sort of like the Bob Costas of Australia. And he does all the Olympics. He does... I think he does football, and he did the tennis for many, many years. He's just a sweetheart of a guy, and I want to hear, as we say goodbye, Rob, I'm going to put you on the spot. I need a little Bruce McAvaney impersonation, please. Give me a little what's going to happen at the tennis 2021 Australian Open in the words of Bruce McAvaney.
Well, what he does is he starts a sentence, and then when he gets truly excited, he drops way down in his vocal register. So he'll say, "There he is, the champion, the king, Novak Djokovic. How good is he?"
I used to see him on the bike every morning. He'd be in there at like 5:30. When I had jet lag, once I got over the jet lag, I wouldn't be up that early. He's Bruce on the bike, killing it, and then he's on the air hours later. And your impersonation of him from, I think it was the Olympics, was just...
Barcelona Olympics. In fact, a friend of mine loved his call so much. He's learned by heart the 400-meter final from the Sydney Olympics between Cathy Freeman. And he learned the entire
I love how you kept interrupting the guy when he kept trying to talk, and you'd keep interrupting because you just keep on talking. Listen, you enjoy yourself. Again, thank you so much. Give my best to Jane and to your five beautiful kids and the dogs who are always welcoming me into your house. And hopefully I'll see you in just about a year from now.
2022, Pat. Lovely to speak to you.
You got it, my man. That's Rob Sitch, everyone, one of the great comedians, writers, directors in the history of Australian arts and television.
Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe is powered by Mudhouse Media.